My name is Jim Marks, and I intend to lead a forum tonight on the morality of warfare. Some from my experience in the military, I've never been involved in any warfare. And my purpose is not just to share some of the things that I've come to, the conclusions I've come to, but to kind of evoke some conversation between people, because I don't intend to convince anybody of any specific thing tonight. I just want to, I just want to bring it up for discussion. Some background about myself. I signed up to enlist in the Marine Corps when I was still in high school. I went active in the Marine Corps about 8 months after I graduated from high school and spent 6 years in the Marine Corps. I was a radar technician on fighter aircraft. I repaired them, I didn't fly them. I spent 2 6-month deployments in the Far East, in the Philippines, Okinawa, Japan, Korea, and those areas around and there. And the last 4 years in the Marine Corps, I spent in Hawaii, and that's where I deployed out of. I was a sergeant when I was discharged, and what this kind of came out of is with the people that I was involved with, both in my work center and the Christians that I was involved with, we were getting into discussions about the morality of warfare and whether or not Christians should actually be involved in warfare. And after reaching certain conclusions that I will discuss tonight, I came to the point that I was no longer really prepared to just go out and go into battle just because somebody said so, just because I was ordered. I felt that if it ever came down to me having to kill somebody, it would have to be a voluntary decision on my own and not just because I was ordered. And the problem with that is, in the military, during a wartime situation, if you are given a lawful order and you disobey it, it's a martial offense, which means you can be executed for it. So disobedience of a lawful order in wartime situation is a martial offense. You can be put to death for disobedience of a lawful order in wartime. And I just felt that I didn't want to be in a position where we go into some country and I'm not sure if it's right or wrong and be ordered to go into battle and have to struggle with the decision, should I do this or should I not? I reached the conclusion then that I was not prepared to go into battle, and as such, I was not prepared to fulfill my obligation or mission as a Marine, which is basic preparedness for battle at any time. So I made a statement, typed it out, and signed it, and gave it to my superior officer, stating basically that I didn't necessarily believe in the morality of warfare. I was not willing to just go into battle just because I was ordered. And since I was not prepared to carry out that mission, I didn't feel that I should be drawing pay as a Marine, and I didn't feel that I should, basically enjoy the benefits. What it was I didn't want to get the pay and have the housing and get the food and get the training and everything and suddenly have a war come up and go, oh, I've been meaning to say something, And I felt that would be a really bad thing. I felt that's the way I really felt, I should tell them now, before it came to a situation with things going on in the world, before it came to a situation where our squadron would be mobilized. So I handed this statement in to my commanding officer, or not my commanding officer, my superior officer, and a 3-hour discussion ensued on my obligation as a Marine and just basic things like that, basically what I had written. And I felt that the guy that was in charge of me, he's a non-commissioned officer in charge, and my superior officer were very understanding and very respectful of my position. But they disagreed, obviously. And I was told that if it came down to it and I was given an order and I disobeyed it, that I would be punished to the full extent of the law. And I said, I know. He said, are you aware that that will happen? And I said, yes, I'm aware, but that doesn't change the morality of the situation. So the result of my non-cooperation is not going to change just because of the severity of the response. Anyway, so I'd like to just get some discussion going on this tonight, just to bring up different feelings. I'm sure that my opinion probably differs from other people's opinion in certain areas, and that's fine. I try to understand how other people feel, and I hope people understand how I feel. I wrote a statement here that will last about 5 minutes in the reading, And so I would like, if just during this 5-minute period, you'd really concentrate on what I'm saying, and then after that, we'll open it up for discussion. So, what I wrote, the basis of Christian morality in any issue is the law of God. The foundation of the law of God can be stated in two principles or commands. The first, love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. The second, love your neighbor as yourself. The whole of Christian law and morality stands on these two commands. These were the two commands that Jesus Christ gave in response to the Pharisees' question, which is the greatest command? Briefly defined, then, love for God is, among other things, obedience to God. Jesus said in the 21st verse of the 14th chapter of John, "Whoever has my commands and obeys them, he is the one who loves me. He who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I too will love him and show myself to him." And again in verses 23 and 24, "If anyone loves me, he will obey my teaching. My Father will love him, and we will come to him and make our home with him. He who does not love me will not obey my teaching." These words you hear are not my own. They belong to the Father who sent me. In the second command, the word neighbor, literally in Greek, means one who is near you. So, we are to love those around us as much as we love ourselves. If we fail to obey the second command, then we have also failed to obey the first. Because if we do not love our neighbor, then we disobey God. This is why John, in his first epistle, said, "If anyone says, 'I love God,' yet hates his neighbor, he is a liar." It was being taught in Jesus' day that you should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But Jesus contradicted this saying, "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Jesus then did not make a distinction between neighbors and enemies, but taught simply that we are to love those around us, whether they love us or not. "If you love those who love you," Jesus said, "what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect." The basis of Christian morality, then, is an absolute love for God without reserve, and a love for those around you that is at least equal to the love you have for yourself. Any thought, desire, word, or action that violates these two commands is, therefore, immoral. How do we view warfare within this definition of morality? Can it be justified? The morality of warfare is an extremely complex issue, and I don't believe there is a simple answer. There are some principles, however, that can help us in our decision-making process. You have heard that it was said, "Eye for eye and tooth for tooth." But I tell you, Jesus said, "Do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." In fact, it was said, "Eye for eye and tooth for tooth," in Exodus 21:24, Leviticus 24:20, and Deuteronomy 19:21. It was a law. And some feel that Jesus here is contradicting or changing the law. But the law was given to limit retribution, not force it. The law said, "You can treat your neighbor no worse than he or she treats you." The purpose of the law, then, was to establish justice. Jesus was saying, "Go beyond justice and show mercy. Treat your neighbor better than you are being treated in accordance with the laws of love." Eye for eye and tooth for tooth is a just law, but it is not a merciful law. Jesus calls us beyond justice to mercy. Jesus calls us to imitate the character of God. And Jesus set the example for us when he died on the cross, an innocent man, seeking not justice against us, but mercy for us. Warfare can be just. Warfare is not merciful. The complexity arises when the question is posed, is it right to take life in order to save it? This is the central paradox in the issue of the morality of warfare. I'd like to share an example that happened. It's an actual example, and it was the example that we have used in discussions to determine whether the taking of life is a just thing to do or not. What happened was there was a man in a grocery market parking lot with a knife, and there was a woman walking through the parking lot, and premeditated or not, I don't know, but the man abducted the woman when he was trying to force her into his car. Another man who was in the parking lot witnessed this and had a pistol either on him or in his car, I'm not sure. Anyway, he was able to get the pistol and to go over and confront the man with the knife who was abducting the woman. And he pointed the pistol at the man with the knife and said, "Drop the knife or I'll shoot you." The man with the knife immediately responded with the knife to the woman's throat, "Drop the pistol or I'll cut her throat." So it was a standoff. A minute later, the man with the knife was dead. He'd been shot through the head. The woman was released unharmed. The man with the pistol was not charged. The question is, was his action just? And in that same situation, if you had the pistol, what would you do? I'd like to open that up for discussion.
Well, one thing I don't believe in violence, but at the same time, I think I would have shot it too. But then you go back on the war, you can think of Hitler, what he done to the Jews, what Hitler done, and I'm sure there's someone here knows that how he went into Norway, how he treated the women and kids in Norway. So that's a big question.
Right. And that's really the question that you face. Can we take life in order to save it?
It would have been possible to shoot him and not kill him, with the intent to wound him seriously enough that he'd be involved with that and not with hurting the woman.
I think, well, the way I learned about this incident was I was looking through a photography thing, and a photographer had been in the area and photographed everything going down. The position of the man with the woman was between the two men. And I think, and I would, in the same situation, if I had decided to shoot, I would have shot to kill, because of the way the man had the woman with the knife, I couldn't be certain that if I only wounded him that she'd be okay. It was the man with the knife's life in balance of the woman's life. And in that immediate situation, I saw the man with the knife in as the unjust, the one committing the crime. But, so what is your response to that? Is there any more?
The man who had the knife, he was willing, quite willing, to take a life, no matter what. That's why he had the knife.
Right.
Well, a knife is more able to kill someone than bare hands.
Right. He was at least intending, or at least capable of bodily harm to the woman. Was he right in shooting then?
I have another question. You said that what happened was the man with the pistol came up and confronted him in such a way that the response of the other man was to then, I mean, he'd apparently just been dragging the woman with the knife handy, but not at her throat.
Well, he was trying to, the way I saw it in the picture was, the first picture I saw was he was at the car with the door open, holding the woman with the knife to her throat, being accosted by the man with the pistol.
But you don't know, I guess what I'm asking is whether he'd actually had the knife that close to the woman's throat or was just threatening to use it on her.
Oh, he had it well in the picture.
And the question is, you know, prior to the time that the man with the pistol accosted him, the question is, would there have been any other way, and we'll never know in that situation, would there have been any other way that the man who decided to depend on the pistol could have found something else to do? Surprise the guy? Thrown a rock at him, ask him if he loved his mother, you know, those kinds of other responses that would throw the man off of his intent.
Right.
just by surprising him or something, and we won't probably ever know in that situation.
Anybody got anything to add to that?
Well, I guess I have a question. I'm having a hard time with the parallel between warfare and this man with the knife in somebody's throat.
Right. I'm trying, and I'm not, they're not in exact parallel. I'm just trying to run through some principles first. Mm-hmm. Okay. The second question I had is, if you were the woman, I was thinking, if the woman, or if I was the woman, by allowing the man with the knife to be shot, was I responsible? Was I as responsible as the man who bore the pistol?
In other words, she could have said, go ahead and... She could have said to the guy with the gun, drop, you know, put in your gun, let him kill me if he wants to. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
Basically. Mm-hmm. Did she have it? Could she have influenced the outcome? Okay, basically what I'm trying to say...
Did?
Yes. Oh.
But still that decision, that final decision is not hers.
No.
There might have been an influencing factor there, but still that decision to take that life, not take that life, whether it was just or unjust, was that person's
right.
decision to take that.
That's true. My feeling was if I was the man with the gun, and it seemed that it was either her life or his, I probably would have shot, and I probably would have shot to kill. If I was the woman, I wonder if I would have had courage enough to try to spare the man's life, even letting him inflict harm.
I think the very first thing that a woman would think. Then, in the aftermath, she would be thinking, could I have done something? Could I have
right.
done something? She would agonize if she were any kind of person. I would think afterwards that a man got killed the first time. But I think the very first thought would be, oh, I thank the Lord, I'm safe. And the moment before, she knew she was facing death.
Right.
What's going on?
The principle that I arrived at is that in that situation, the man showed as much mercy as he could. He said, if you drop the knife, I will not shoot. When he could show no more mercy, he acted justly. He judged the man with the knife in a sense. He said, what you are doing is something that is worthy of death if you do not stop what you're doing. He made a judgment on the man's life. He set a principle down. He set a law down. He was basically, by his actions, saying anyone that is doing this would be justified in being put to death. So I came to the conclusion that it can be just and right to take a human life. But taking that to the battlefield, when you face somebody on the battlefield, you're not necessarily facing someone who is there to kill because they want to kill. You're facing someone who has very good chances, a family, a wife and children, who comes from a country that is fairly similar to yours, a different political system perhaps. You're facing someone who probably has the same image of you that you have of them, someone who is following their leader in the same way that you are following your leader, and someone who really probably doesn't want to be there any more than you want to be there. And yet they're going to take your life if they can. On the battlefield, in that situation, is it right for a Christian to take the life of his enemy?
Are they enemies, though?
That's one. Okay, good question.
I have two thoughts. Going back, when you asked if I were the woman, what would I do? I was wondering if I were the man with the pistol, that it would probably be better if he weren't there at all. Although he witnessed it, he could have probably left and then had the woman somehow deal with the man. Because I've heard of incidents where women have been almost abducted, but because of their self-defense, they've been able to get out of that situation.
But if you saw somebody there with a knife to their throat, could you walk off?
No, but I wonder how much he influenced, all that action.
Right.
So on the battlefield, just being present there is probably influencing all the killing.
In other words, if I'm standing before you dressed in combat fatigues with a weapon and a couple of magazines of rounds, you're probably not going to deal with me as a possible friend.
And as a Christian, you should be there on the battlefield in combat.
I think you can apply that. I think it's a good observation. Can you apply that to if the man with the gun in the parking lot decided to do nothing? Is he and the lady was later abducted or killed, or would the man be responsible for her harm? If a country went into a war believing they were protecting the innocent, but you chose not to go to war for that cause, would the country be guilty of doing the same thing a man would be doing if he left the scene without trying to solve the problem? I don't know, I just see some parallels there.
Well, I think, Christians should take a passive view on these kind of things. And not to say that women should be getting killed and we should walk in this way from situations, but I think, I don't know, I might be an idealist, but I think that there would be a way out if you took more of a passive action instead of using the same kind of weapon. Because I've heard of this incredible thing that happened to this woman. This one man tried to abduct her, and it was in this parking lot that I used to go to all the time in Minneapolis. And he was ready to he had raped her, he was ready to kill her. And in the process, they were on this hill, and she was lying down naked. And he had was just about to rape her. And he had put the knife down in the soil. And while he was undressing himself, she went down, she sort of scooted down, got the knife and stabbed him. And then she ran away. But in this case, later when she talked about the scene, she said that she had total control in the whole thing. She had been with him about an hour. And throughout the whole thing, she had thought of when her chance would be, because she knew that there was going to be a chance that she could get out.
How does that apply to the situation?
That if you have, in this case, I don't know, not everybody's going to be as confident as she is, but I don't know, if I were in that position, it's easy to say this, but I think I would react in the same way. If there was a man with a knife, I would wait for the chance to get away. And always be aware.
Janelle had something to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, I don't know, when Steve was talking, I got the idea that he thought, that the man could either shoot or he could walk away.
Right.
But there are other alternatives. The guy could have gone and pitched the police, or he could have tried to talk the guy out of it. And when you apply that to actual warfare, there are other ways of countries coming to agreements without having to resort to war.
Dan?
I was going to say similar. One problem with the way we're trained almost that violence is a solution to problems that limits creativity. And then the other, so my mind starts thinking, well, shoot the tires, I mean, you need the car to get away. But then, that might be dumb. But the other one is that this man with a gun had went into the situation totally defending his own life. There wasn't any sense that he would endanger himself for the sake of this woman. But then the first point, when you apply to international relations, it seems obvious to me now that our government is approaching other countries totally with military solutions. Mm-hmm. Like in Central America, without the tedious, patient, creative task of speaking, talking, and communicating. I understanding. We tend to think there's nothing in between total passiveness and violence. It just destroys our creativity.
Antonis.
Those two people that were in the parking lot, you guys are, there was, I'm sure, a lot of stress there, a lot of adrenaline flowing, and that this guy with the gun just thought of this girl probably getting sliced, and that, you know, he, in the state of mind at that time, I mean, this very situation, you know, it's easy to say, well, I would have shot tires or something like that, but, you know.
Sir, would you mind, I lost a niece that was murdered. Kidnapped, murdered, 13 years old, very beautiful girl. I was in World War II. If you don't mind, would you excuse me and I'll go home?
Okay.
Kind of the issue that is brought in my mind, can we have love for our enemy and love for our neighbor at the same time if our enemy attacks our neighbor?
It's not directly related to that, but it has to do with what Dan said. As we think about options and situations, we are pretty limited on what we think of, and one I hadn't thought of. What would have happened if the man with no weapon, I mean the man that had the pistol, had walked up to the man with no weapon and had said, unhand that woman, and had been willing to jump in there and let the man stab him.
Right.
I mean, when we think about Christian options, that is one, to die for that woman. That way, you're not responsible for killing anybody and you're not allowing anybody to kill somebody else. And the interesting, you might say, well, that might just threaten the man and he'd stab the woman anyway. But probably not. He's probably going to be so put off by the fact that there's somebody just walks right up to this situation, starts talking to him, says, I'm sorry, I'm not going to let you do that to that woman. You know, we have her. I imagine that would put him off balance and would be so unexpected that either he would just sort of do nothing, you know, and let the woman escape, or would actually attack the man, feeling like the man would be more threatening in some way. And that would solve the problem. I mean, I'm not saying I'm ready to do that, but I'd like to.
Well,
and I think that does have to do with international relations to a certain extent, too, to say maybe if we're willing to die rather than kill, that will have an effect on what we see as solution.
That's one of the things that a question that really came to my mind and a possible solution. If we are supposed to love our enemy, and if we are supposed to love our neighbor, and our neighbor attacks our enemy, or excuse me, our enemy attacks our neighbor, what is, as Christians, what is our response? Is it to go in a violent attitude, like Dan was saying we often do? Are we, as a nation of people, I see the nation of God as those believers in every country being one nation of God. I don't see a political group of people being a nation of God. I think that as believers, we are all a nation of God. And when we see an unjust situation, of a neighbor, of an enemy attacking a neighbor, what is our response as a Christian? Are we supposed to go in with weapons? Are we supposed to obey? Are Christians, is it God's plan that Christians obey their respective governments and meet on the battlefield to kill each other? If our government declares war on a nation, what will our response be? If we are against war, what are we doing now? That's some of the things that are going through my mind.
I think it's important to realize that we're not talking anymore about battlefields in a lot of cases, that all of us are involved in war preparation for a war that won't be happening on battlefields, it'll be happening everywhere, and that our complicity is now, not when war is actually declared and somebody pushes the first button. I mean, even though there will continue to be the hot spot kinds of things where the Marines go.
So by not doing anything now, we're in effect supporting the war effort, you're saying?
I think so. I think every time I let them build one more bomb, that I am complicit in the deaths that those bombs will cause.
How can we affect a solution to oppression in the world now, other than going to war?
Feed the hungry, clothe the naked.
Go ahead.
I think it's important to not let the situation get out of hand and go to the point where it's very emotional, very stressful. Through diplomatic relations, diplomatic ways of taking care of problems.
What about situations such as happened in 1941 when the Japanese were negotiating with the United States, and the United States was negotiating with the Japanese to try to find some sort of common meeting ground? And on December 7th, the bombs rained down on Pearl Harbor.
Right.
No. Good question. Apparently, diplomacy had failed at that point. And here's an immediate thing that you've got to take care of, or, well, you could ignore it too, I guess. No one seemed to feel they wanted to ignore it.
Right.
And in your view, in your presentation, a military response might have been justified, although not merciful.
My premise is that war can be just, but war is not really merciful.
Theoretically, it can be just.
Theoretically, it can be just. But I think in each situation, we are under the responsibility to make that decision ourselves. I don't think you can say war is wrong across the board. Like the man that left. What about Hitler? What about the Holocaust? What about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor? And we should not forget the things that we have done to other countries. The South Vietnamese were treated very harshly by both the North Vietnamese and the Americans. We are not that much more clean or pure than some other countries in the world that we call our enemies in some situations. We have done just as many things in some wars as our enemies have done. So I think a war can be just, but a war is not merciful. So how are we going to make that determination? And what are we going to do now as our nation continues to prepare for war?
And what, even answering your question.
How do you respond to an attack?
Jim, I was wondering about, sometimes I get frustrated when we say, what are we going to do about that? Because ultimately then I think we have to say, well, we have to talk to those people that are in charge, and we have to somehow, we have to affect the people that are on the upper echelon, Congress, and even those that are superior officers. And I was wondering, what kind of mentality are we working with then when we talk to superior officers? What do you think they feel? What did your superior officer feel when you said, I don't feel it's right for me to go to war, and I want you to know that. And I don't feel that, I feel that war may be just, but it may not be merciful. What do you think he would respond, or how did he respond, or maybe?
He said that I had a responsibility to fulfill the agreement that I made when I contracted with the United States Marine Corps. He said if anyone protects his family, he will kill them. And he's a very intelligent man and compassionate. It's just that he is willing to fight for all that he has. In my mind, I understand that. And if somebody attacked my family, I don't know that I could just stand there. The people in the military are people. They have families too. And they don't want, you know, they don't want to lose their family, their freedom, their lives, their possessions, any more than the families that live in other countries do. But where Christianity departs from secular thinking on the morality of war is I believe that Christians really don't have as much to lose as everyone else in a war. We can't lose our lives, and our possessions aren't worth as much. But how still do we respond to those that we love being attacked. That's where I'm stuck. That's where I'm at.
Maybe part of the answer is just doing everything you can without resorting to violence.
I've heard of a phrase, it's called waging peace.
Could you, what was waging peace? I'm not sure I understand that.
Waging peace is an aggressive, offensive effort to establish peace before war.
That's where I get really frustrated with our foreign policy. We seem to, you know, our security is based on quote, our number of bombs, etc. When it seems like these countries would be our friends so much more if we would go in and help them start grassroots agriculture and get the people fed, and then that in turn, you know, this is probably real idealistic too, but have that in turn be the security. I see that so much more as a security than all of us sitting around, you know, with this hair trigger business with the nuclear. And I don't know, it just seems like we view security in just an odd manner. And, you know, and we get all upset about the Sandinista government and then we cut off loans to them. When, you know, why aren't we in there doing, you know, really looking at what's going on there, the goodwill for the people, you know, that the literacy rate's gone up. And I just get so aggravated. It's like this administration has a black and white view. The communists wear a white hat, or a black hat, and we wear the white hat. And I don't know, it's really frustrating.
Sometimes I see us as thinking as though we are American citizens and we have to do something as a group of American citizens. And then I think, first, we are citizens of the kingdom of God, and second, we are American citizens. And if our government is not down there doing that, that does not stop us from doing that. Even if we have to act without the backing of our government. Who is our king? Who is our leader? Who is the one that we follow? I guess I've stated that question that I have. How are we supposed to, as Christians, what is our response to warfare? Do we see warfare as a valid alternative or a valid solution? And if not, what is our response? The little girl that sang here today, there's little girls like that in each country around the world. Just like us. Are we supposed to go in there and kill them because our government says so?
I think a point that can be brought up is the situation in Iran with the hostages and the situation that was in Granada. They were two very similar, both involved Americans, and in Iran they did take a hostage, in Granada there was the possibility of them being taken hostage. Two different, one situation pretty much the same, two different solutions.
And people were killed the second way, and they weren't killed, there was not a large number killed the first way.
I think the people in Iran suffered, the Americans suffered much more mental anguish than did those who were, quote, rescued in Grenada, the Americans. Pros and cons both ways.
Mm-hmm. Responding to you, what does one do when situations of attack happen? John Moore Yoder has got a book out that's now, I think, in the bookstore called something like What Happens When? What Do You Do When? And it's specifically talking about the questions. These questions come up every time there's a discussion about violence and pacifism and war. Is but what if? What if? And so he apparently has collected some what ifs. He's got a theory of what if. And it really might be worth exploring. I really think the key is that once we as Christians or as other concerned people realize the answer isn't violence, then we're going to be opened up to explore the incredible variety of other options that there are. An example has to do with this Iranian hostage crisis. I don't know if anybody else has noticed, but in the last 20 years, hostage situations have changed. It used to be hostages always got killed. You know, there'd be a whole bunch of people killed. Somebody rush in to rescue them, lots of people killed. And then the art, I guess, of nonviolent, yes, of talking, has developed. It's a science that is developing. We know more about it than we did 20 years ago. And it's rare now in hostage situations in inner cities, you know, when somebody takes over a liquor store or whatever. I think it's getting to the point it's rare that anybody gets killed because people have the skills. And I think that's true internationally if we just start looking at those options, insisting that our government look at those options. I think that's the freedom that we have as people that don't trust and believe in the ultimate value of violence, then we have lots more options to look at.
It's interesting that when you're talking about that, and you're going back to if one reads Jimmy Carter's memoirs, and he really says that we had to try everything we could not. And then, of course, the violent kind of helicopter assault failed totally. And I think in his memoirs, he says he was against that all along, but he never ever say, you know, that should have failed to let other people make the decision. But when you talk about alternatives to facing, using force to face force, and our first reaction, I think because of our culture, is using force, I mean, getting the gun, shooting the person. And somehow we have to start in the very beginning of our lives and change the cultural idea of making solutions. So you start, somehow you need to start with children and help them learn that there are other ways to do things, and it may be too late for all of us. Somebody speaks harshly to us, we speak harshly back, and that's in the cartoon, whenever you watch, somebody gets bopped on the head, the guy gets bopped back harder. I mean, that's the way our culture's set up, and that's what we're letting our children learn. And I don't know how one changes.
It is changing, though. I mean, there are groups against violence on TV, and TV has gotten less violent. Cartoons.
It's interesting to read some of the examples set by Mohandas Gandhi or Martin Luther King on nonviolent non-cooperation to an unjust situation. How they face their enemies and use no weapons and eventually achieve their aims. I see. You know, some of the things we asked, if Christ was on the battlefield, what would he do?